From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in Denver today. This is Here and Now. And with just 2 weeks until Election Day, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are campaigning in Florida. We're here in Battleground, Colorado for our election road trip, and we'll have much more on the election coming up.
Well, and the election dovetails with our first story. If you buy your health insurance through a government-run federal or state exchange, your premiums on average could be 22% more for a mid-level plan next year, according to new data from the Obama administration. And if you're shopping around for a new plan on the exchange, you might have fewer options to choose from because several insurers have dropped out of the marketplace. Sarah Cliff covers health policy for Vox.com. And Sarah, this is happening at the worst time. The Obama administration have been scrambling with big pushes on social media to get young, healthy people to sign up when new open enrollment starts November 1st to bring costs down. So remind us, why are our premiums going up so significantly?
So premiums are going up for a few reasons. One, like you mentioned, there's a lot less insurance carriers this year. You have a lot of states that have just one insurance plan, and that concentration is really leading to higher premiums when you don't have any competition. Another reason, like you mentioned, is young adults, that we have seen fewer than expected young people sign up for Obamacare. The administration hasn't really hit its targets for young adult enrollment. And one of the reasons that matters is young people tend to be healthier. They tend to have less healthcare needs. And that helps bring down the premiums for everyone. So those two things really clash together in kind of a perfect storm for raising premiums.
Right. It's a vicious cycle because some of the insurance companies are saying we're covering too many of the unhealthiest, and we're not getting help from the healthy, and they're dropping out. Look, a lot of people who buy on these government exchanges are low income, not low enough, obviously, for Medicaid, but low enough that they get government subsidies. But something like, I think, 17% don't. So what? Tell us more about what these cost increases mean for them.
Yeah, so for that 17% of people who aren't getting subsidies, this is going to be really hard. And I think it's a really big question of what those people decide to do. You could guess that on one hand, these are people who might have really chronic healthcare conditions. The reason they're buying unsubsidized is because they think they're going to need their health insurance. So they might be unhappy about a 20% increase and decide to pay for it. Or they might say, you know what, that's too much. I could barely afford my premium before. I'm going to sit it out. And I think that's the worrisome scenario for the administration. I think, like you mentioned, the folks with subsidies, they are a little bit protected and insulated from these premium increases. But that still leaves a few million people who aren't getting subsidies, and they're in a very tough spot with their premiums this year.
Well, what does this tell us about the long-term viability of the Affordable Care Act? You know, where Jeremy's reporting from Colorado today, where there's been a push to start a state universal care plan and drop out altogether. That is probably going to fail on this go-around of public voting on it. But, you know, will more states drop out? What has to happen?
So I think the administration really wants to see enrollment increase, and I think that is pretty key. They released data last week saying they think a million more people will join the marketplaces. That now feels very optimistic given what we know about the premium increases. And I think so they're focused on enrollment. They're also focused on making sure that insurers stay in the market. They had dozens of carriers leave the market last year. About one in three counties in the United States only has one Obamacare plan. So a disaster scenario, the scenario they really don't want, is some place in the country where no insurance company will sell on the Obamacare marketplaces. Mm-hmm. There's really not a fallback plan for that. So I think their focus right now is just making sure the insurers that are still on the market stay in the market and seeing if they can bump up enrollment a little bit to make the market more appealing, to make it bigger and maybe entice a few more insurance plans to rejoin in 2018.
Well, and some people are saying that this is just growing pains.
It's very hard to tell right now. You know, one of the big questions that is hard to understand is this big increase a one-time kind of writing of the course? Are they one-time correcting for bad information they had before? Or is this the start of some big rate increases in Obamacare?
Right. And an unraveling.
Most people I've talked to this morning think it is a one-time course correction. But they also think it is possible that that if healthy people drop out, we could see more big rate increases in the future.
Well, Donald Trump definitely thinks, as he's been saying today, it's over for Obamacare. He also misspoke. He said his employees were being hurt by this, but his employees presumably get employer health insurance from him, and people have pointed that out to him. And just be clear about that. This is about the exchanges, not about employer-directed health insurance.
Yeah, so this is a big problem politically. A lot of people will hear about these premium increases, hear about insurance premiums going up. But most of us, myself included, about 85% of Americans under 65 are getting their insurance at work. Mm-hmm. And this has nothing to do with your insurance if you get insurance at your workplace. Yeah. This is for the specific group of 10 million people who get insurance on the marketplaces.
Yeah, and it's going to hurt them. Sarah Cliff covers health policy for Vox. Sarah, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, on Election Day, voters in Washington state will decide whether or not to put a tax on carbon emissions. If Initiative 732 passes, the state would charge for every ton of CO2 emitted from generating electricity or using fossil fuels in Washington. It would be the first such tax in the country. Ashley Ahern from Here and Now contributor KUOW and EarthFix in Seattle reports.
If you could make energy companies pay $25 for every ton of CO2 they emitted, would you? Okay, now how about if that tax meant your gasoline cost 25 cents more per gallon and your electric bill goes up? But to sweeten the deal, let's say some of the revenue from that tax was used to reduce the state's sales tax, and some of the money went back to low-income families in the form of a tax credit. That's the pitch Carbonwa, the group pushing for the carbon tax, is making to voters in Washington state this fall. I met up with them as they rang doorbells in Seattle.
Okay, thanks for showing up, guys.
Ben Selesky is an organizer for Carbonwa. He's 26 and the oldest one here. The rest are all volunteers in high school or their early 20s.
We're out here because we're clearly not moving fast enough to avoid ecological disaster, and so we're trying to use bigger tools in the toolbox here, and we're trying to get it passed through a ballot initiative and a grassroots effort, and that's what we intend to do.
Ben passes out clipboards with some surveys and sample scripts for the volunteers. They do some practice rounds, and then...
All right, sounds good. Let's meet back here at 12:30. Let's win.
The group splits off in pairs. I head up the hill with Ben. He's got his clipboard in his hand and a backpack over his shoulder.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. We're volunteers with Initiative 732. We're just doing a quick 3-question community survey. How concerned are you about climate change and carbon pollution?
Very concerned.
Gotcha.
Ben explains how I-732 works, and the man listens, nodding his head.
Question. If the vote were tomorrow, on a scale of 1 to 5, how do you think you'd vote?
I would vote yes.
Awesome. Fantastic. Would you like a free yard sign delivered to your house?
No.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, thank you.
In the grand scheme of things, the 732 campaign hasn't raised gobs of money, but supporters of the carbon tax have contributed 3 times as much money as those who oppose it. Among the opponents, you've got steel manufacturers, pulp and paper makers, electric utilities. Not surprising, since a carbon tax will cost them. But there are other opponents of the carbon tax who might surprise you.
So if the vote were tomorrow, how would you vote on 732?
No.
I'd vote no.
I met up with Paulina Lopez and Rebecca Saldana in South Park, Seattle. This is one of the poorest, most polluted zip codes in the city. Asthma and obesity rates are high here, and people die up to 13 years earlier than people in wealthier parts of the city. One of Paulina's kids has asthma.
We live in the same city, but yet we're from very different realities.
Lopez is an organizer with the Duwamish River Cleanup Coalition, and Saldana is the executive director of Puget Sound SAGE, an environmental justice group. The initiative might cut the sales tax by 1 percentage point, but Saldana says it still leaves poor people and communities of color behind.
Spending $100 on groceries and being able to have 1% of that less in sales tax is not going to make their families healthier. It's not going to clean their air. It's not going to create the infrastructure investments that we need to do. That's the part that's unfortunate.
Some of the revenue from the carbon tax would provide a tax credit to more than 450,000 low-income families in Washington state. But there's no money for environmental programs like boosting clean energy, public transportation, or creating green jobs. Other mainstream environmental groups like Climate Solutions and the Sierra Club do not support the carbon tax because it doesn't actually put a limit on CO2 emissions. It just charges a tax to emit them. Paulina Lopez says that the carbon tax isn't the right policy for Washington, but she's encouraged by what she's seeing in her community around the issue of climate change. People are getting more and more engaged.
that big movement, big voices coming are from people of color. And I think that's what the big difference is, because the people of color are being the impacted. So who are going to be the ones speaking? It's going to be us who are trying to make our voice being heard.
So far, though, the environmental groups who oppose the carbon tax initiative haven't been able to put together a more viable policy. Washington Governor Jay Inslee has not been able to pass a carbon trading program, and the state's latest attempt at capping carbon emissions under the Clean Air Act is already facing legal challenges from the fossil fuel industry. But that industry isn't coming out against Washington's carbon tax initiative, even though they fought California's cap and trade program 4 years ago. Voters are pretty divided on Initiative 732. Some polling shows that a third of them support a carbon tax, a third of them oppose it, and the rest are undecided. For Ben Selesky of Carbon Wa, a carbon tax may not be the perfect solution, but it's the most concrete action he can take right now to fight climate change. So he's working to get I-732 passed one doorbell at a time.
You know, we have one job, to get this message in front of voters, and there's enough voters out there who care about this issue that we can win easily. It's just a question of finding them in time.
For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Ahern in Seattle.
Yesterday, we heard how the presidential race is playing out among Colorado's Republicans. We heard from two voters who are supporting Donald Trump and from some of the state's conservative leaders who are not, at least actively, supporting their party's candidate. Today, we're going to hear from one of the state's most prominent Hillary Clinton supporters, Governor John Hickenlooper. We met him in his office, and I asked him if there are things he's learned about Hillary Clinton involving emails or Benghazi or anything else that have given him pause about his candidate.
No, I really haven't, just because I had that, you know, I got vetted as a possible VP candidate. And so I had several hours with her, pretty much unfettered. And every single question I could ask her, she answered directly and candidly and was as forthcoming as I could ever imagine, a candidate for high elected office ever to be. I mean, we haven't seen someone like this. I mean, she knows more about public policy than anyone at any level I've ever met.
But what about some of the things that have bothered other people, like the speech that was leaked in which she said that there was a need for a public and a private position?
Well, I think now that was since I had talked to her, but I would assume, as I tried to put myself in her place there, when you're talking to a group, you try to keep your same core argument exactly the same, but you present it in a different light. Trade. Let's just take trade. A lot of anger around TPP now. People want to pull down. You know, when you look at TPP, there are some problems. I think there's some places where it could be improved. But I believe we need more trade, right? I think trade in the last 20 years, there have certainly been millions of Americans that have not gotten a fair deal out of it. I think we should figure out how to move them into the new economy, make sure they get the training and the support. But let's not miss the fact that we've raised a couple billion people out of poverty around the world. So trade historically makes the world safer. It helps American businesses export. Trade agreements allow us to get more, a higher level of payment for our wheat and our beef and all these things.
So are you in favor of TPP?
No, I think the TPP should be amended, improved.
And then signed.
Well, whether it's TPP or whatever takes its place, I am in favor of figuring out trade agreements that are fair to all sides. And, you know, this is a basic principle of business. You never get everything you want. And I think the same is true in trade and how the public looks at it. The public's probably not going to be satisfied completely with whatever happens, but it doesn't mean that trade is bad. It just means that TPP is bad. So going back to your initial question, it gets into when you talk about it, you talk about trade being positively, but in a positive sense, but you might come back on the TPP and say, well, that's something that could be improved.
You made it into one of the emails that came out of WikiLeaks, and it said, it is no secret that the governor would happily consider a cabinet position. Now, that may not surprise people. Because
I never heard that.
You were obviously, as you said, vetted to be VP. But would you be interested in a cabinet position if Hillary Clinton wins?
I want to go back and see that thing, because the one WikiLeaks I did see was that one of John Podesta's emails suggested back when in 2008 that I would be a good candidate for, I forget it was agriculture or some cabinet position. I said, no one ever told me back then I was being considered. How could I have not? Someone should have at least told me. I would have been so complimented. And so, you know, it would have made me just feel, you know, more successful in the world. You know, I have 2 years right now, about 2 1/3 years left in my 2 terms as governor of Colorado. And it's hard to imagine a place where I could have more impact and do more good. I mean, we're working on here.
Than here?
Yeah. Then in the state of Colorado, we're doing some workforce training things right now. And you know, you talk about retraining people who've their careers have been outsourced through, you know, more competitive international trade. One way to help them is to take a lot of what we're doing here around skills-based discussions around workforce training and accelerate it. So I'd have to be really pushed for cabinet positions. I love what I'm doing. If you know, the president-elect comes and says, you are essential to my vision of what we can do for this country, that's a hard thing to say no to, but I'm not going to go out and compete.
We've been speaking to voters in this state, in Colorado, and spoke with some Trump supporters over the weekend, one of whom said that she was supporting Donald Trump because she was upset that it seemed accepted in Washington that 1% or 2% economic growth was about as good as we can do right now. And she felt that Donald Trump was saying to her, I can get to 4%, I can get to 5% or 6%. What do you think? Do you think that 1% or 2% economic growth is the new normal in America?
Well, I'll tell you one thing, that Donald Trump never gave us any example of how he was going to get to 4 or 5 or 6%. And 4 or 5 and 6%, those are steep hills. I think we can get there. I'm not sure we can get to 6%, but I think we can get to 3% or 4%. But we've got to really slim down. I mean, I think we've got to cut red tape. And Secretary Clinton talks about cutting red tape frequently. I think those are the kinds of differences we can make. And you know, her infrastructure, this notion of we're stuck with the traffic congestion we see in almost every major city in the country. I mean, the country is crying out for, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of new construction. That in itself is going to, you know, help drive the economy because it's going to get people to work quicker. It's going to allow businesses to be more efficient. Broadband, she wants to make sure there's more high-speed internet. You know, everyone's complaining about the same thing. They don't have the speed to access information that they need or that they feel that they should be able to have. And that's going to take another massive investment that, again, we'll all have to pay for it. I'm not saying it. We don't have to find the resources for it, but it will help us grow our nation's economy more rapidly.
Well, speaking of growth, this is a state that is just booming right now, population-wise, and you're dealing with the growing pains of that. A lot of traffic, as you mentioned, on the highways, and housing prices going up and things like that. What have you learned about how to deal with growth over the last many years in Colorado?
Well, growth is the consequence of success, right? If you're, whether you're a business, a city, or a state, you know, you're trying to grow. Nothing stays the same. And if you're shrinking, it's a whole different kettle of fish, right? It's a much worse situation. But growth, the trick is you've got to get way out ahead of it. I would argue that's a big part of why Denver and Colorado have done so well is we have invested in our future.
But you're still dealing with terrible traffic.
That's the problem with success is that imagine if we hadn't done that investment, we'd be sunk. But the bottom line is now we're looking at the next generation of infrastructure and how do we expand our capacity at the same time dealing with the traffic we have right today, expand our capacity for the next 5 and 10 years.
I want to ask you about marijuana because 5 states are voting on Election Day about whether to legalize recreational marijuana, including California. 4 more states, medical. This state, both of those are legal. I know you weren't in favor of it at the time, but what do you think about how it's worked out in Colorado to have legal recreational marijuana?
Yeah, I did oppose it when it was on the ballot 4 years ago. I think the jury's still out. And when other governors ask me, I tell them they should wait a couple of years. But I will say that we have come a long way. And a lot of our fears and our nightmares haven't come to pass. We haven't seen a big spike of teenage consumption. We haven't seen some of the you know, driving while high. We were very worried that we'd see a dramatic increase in that. Some indications that people smoke it more frequently now, adults, and that we have seen an increase in teenage consumption, but not a huge amount. So we're trying to put more money towards marketing, telling teenagers that this high THC marijuana, when your brain's still growing rapidly as a teenager, it has a high probability of taking a sliver of your long-term memory permanently. And that's a very bad idea for teenagers to even think about using high THC marijuana as while they're still teenagers. And we're going to get that message out. But the fear that it was going to be a giant spike really hasn't happened.
So your advice to other governors right now would be?
I would say wait a year or two. That's what I've said pretty consistently.
If they have the choice, although in this case they don't, because
right, exactly.
The people will decide.
Well, exactly. They're in the situation like I am that you say, you know, I opposed it. But once they voted for it, it's my job to make sure that we do the very best we can to try and make a regulatory system that works.
I have one other question that I have to ask you, which is I say Colorado, but people here, it seems like, say Colorado. Well, how do you say it? And what's the difference?
I say Colorado.
Do it again?
Colorado.
Okay.
Like the people here. I think when I came out here, I said Colorado. It's like Nevada or Nevada, right? When you're in the West, everybody says Nevada.
So do people get annoyed when I say Colorado?
No, they just figure you're from, you know, from
outside,
Boston.
Right.
You're from away. It's you know, my brew pub that I started back in when I got after I got laid off as a geologist, and I couldn't find any work back in the mid '80s. So I opened this brew pub down in what's now called Lodo, Lower Downtown Denver, in 1988, and we named it. It's the corner of 18th and Wynkoop Street, Wynkoop, and so we call it Wynkoop. But then a lot of people started calling and saying, "Well, but it's Wynkoop," and it became apparent very soon after we opened that it was almost 50-50. So from then on, I tried to encourage people to pronounce it the opposite way that they were, so that they would start discussions and arguments over the dinner table at home, so that it would keep the name top of mind. It was cheap, sleazy marketing.
Very smart marketing, yeah. Well, Governor John Hickenlooper of Colorado, thank you so much for having us.
Oh, you bet. It's my pleasure. Enjoyed it.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
The low unemployment rate, below 5%, is causing some headaches for retailers looking for seasonal workers. According to the job search site Indeed.com, retailers started looking for the temporary holiday workers back in August, a month earlier than they usually do. Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal joins us now from New York. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Robin.
So the National Retail Federation predicts that retailers will hire as many as 690,000 seasonal workers this year. That's the same as last year, just about the same as last year. But what? What is the problem?
Well, but they're needing to hire them earlier, and that's in anticipation of greater competition for the available workers out there, and they're fewer of them. And that's, as you mentioned before, due to unemployment holding at around 5% for the past year. And then retailers, they're also facing hiring competition from logistics firms, distribution centers, all this e-commerce that continues to grow.
Mm-hmm. So there's a smaller pool to choose from. But is this, you know, kind of a good thing in a way?
Well, if you're a worker, it certainly is. It means that, hey, you're being courted. There are more benefits being offered to you. And, you know, the wages are also going up. For example, someone who makes around $14 an hour in a full-time job, you know, that's in the lower quarter of earners. They're experiencing an increase of 4%. That's in the third quarter compared to last year. And, I mean, their wages are growing all across the board. Median workers, it's about 3%.
Yeah. Well, what kind of jobs are there? Who's taking them?
Who's taking them? Well, I mean, the jobs are a lot of the things that you would expect to be required during the holiday season. More people behind the counters. You need more people who are especially packing up and shipping stuff off. I've been into a lot of these distribution centers, and I mean, they see a massive increase during the months right before Christmas. One example would be Honey Baked Ham Company. They're planning to hire 12,000 seasonal workers, and they're actually going to, as an incentive to try to get people to take the job, they're bringing back an old practice of offering these seasonal workers two hams. They get one for Thanksgiving and one for Christmas if they complete all of their pre-holiday shifts.
Woohoo. So there's that. We mentioned that the hiring will be ultimately about the same, but some stores are hiring more. JCPenney is adding 20% more seasonal staff this year than last, and that's to the stores. Amazon is hiring 20% more seasonal workers to its warehouses. So within that, framework, some companies are hiring much more than they did last year.
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, as you just pointed out, there's a lot of those jobs are in the e-commerce sector where there's you need all hands on deck this time of year.
Yeah.
You're also seeing newer companies. One example is BevMo, a California wine cellar. They're needing more workers, and so they're offering more wine and beer tasting, large employee discounts than they did in the past. And so there are a lot of smaller companies out there that are doing more enterprising kind of startup type work where they have e-distribution platforms or e-commerce platforms, and so they need people to help get their goods out.
Well, play your cards right. You could get ham and a glass of wine along with your seasonal job. Jason Bellini, The Wall Street Journal, thanks so much.
You bet.
And we're broadcasting today from Colorado as part of our election road trip. It's a state that, as we talked about yesterday, has already legalized medical and recreational marijuana. But one veteran of the Iraq War has sued the state in the hopes of getting Colorado to go a step further and list PTSD as a condition that can be treated with pot. That's something 18 other states have done. I met Iraq War veteran Kurt Bean at his workplace, a timber company outside of Denver, and asked him why he's fighting to get veterans access to medical marijuana for PTSD.
Well, there's a variety of reasons, of course. The biggest one being there needs to be as many resources as possible to allow veterans to be successful. And one big one to be successful is to be clear of anxiety, clear of depression, clear of insomnia, and clear of any kind of pain they're having. And medical marijuana is a great way to, fix all those problems with a healthy and positive solution.
Although the studies that exist out there so far, I guess, are not good enough for the Colorado Department of Public Health. They say that the evidence doesn't exist yet. They don't know. They don't have enough peer-reviewed studies to say what you're saying.
Which is a really silly statement because they don't allow enough research to be had to, allow them to do enough studies to prove that it is a valuable commodity for veterans and for the society.
Now, some people may wonder, well, what's the big deal in Colorado? Because as somebody of age, you can go and buy marijuana if you want it for recreational use and just use it for PTSD.
Right, of course. Yeah, but there's a couple of big problems with that. For one, when you go into a dispensary, and you say, hey, I have PTSD. This is how they'll specifically treat it, through their avenues. And also, medical marijuana is about half the price of recreational marijuana. So if you're using marijuana regularly to treat certain symptoms, it's going to add up really fast to be something that can, may not be sustainable for you long term if it's twice as cost as it usually is. And lastly, the biggest problem is the perception of medical marijuana not being a valuable use for PTSD. If there was a standard that the medical marijuana was applicable for PTSD, then more veterans would use it. Right now, everyone's looking at, in Colorado, all these veterans that are trying to abide the legal system. They're like, hey, medical marijuana isn't an option for me because the state hasn't deemed it an option for me right now, which is really silly to me.
You feel that there's a stigma for people to go in and buy it recreationally if what they want to do is use it medically?
Yeah, there is a stigma, and there's a lot of veterans, myself included, when I first got out of the military, I never tried marijuana before. And there's a stigma attached to marijuana in general. And until you try it, until you experience it, until you know, how it can affect you in a positive way, you don't know, the after effects and, the ripple effects, how you can be a functional adult in society. A lot of these veterans are on so many opiates and so many different drugs they can barely function, you know. And then they get off of those opiates and get on the medical marijuana, and they're, you know, producers in their society and their family life and their community, which is a huge part of it, is our whole country successful. If our veterans are successful, our country in the whole, as a whole, will be successful.
Did you ever think that when you went to Iraq that you would be somebody that was dealing with PTSD afterwards?
I don't know. I mean, like, I never, I mean, it wasn't, you know, in your head when you're over there. Like, when you're in war and when you're a soldier, you're really focused on what's in front of you, not that you're thinking about, you know, what's coming after. You just want to survive, you know. So, no, I didn't really think about it. I knew near the end of my service that it was going to be an issue, because I had guys that got out before I did and said, hey, start filing your status and start, you know, applying for different programs. So that way when you get out, you're going to be successful. And you know, I did a little bit of that, but not nearly enough, for sure.
That's Kurt Bean, who is leading the fight to get PTSD listed in Colorado as a condition that can be treated by medical marijuana. As his lawsuit makes its way through the courts, a legislative panel has endorsed what he's asking for. That endorsement means the issue will be sent to the Colorado State Senate, which returns to work in January. Well, one of the most well-known TV shows that takes place in Colorado is South Park, the Comedy Central cartoon that's been around since 1997. And this year, it's gotten very political. Joining us now is Ryan Parker of The Hollywood Reporter, and by the way, a Colorado native. Ryan, welcome.
Hello there.
And first of all, South Park has made some interesting choices in how they cover this election, starting with making Mr. Garrison a stand-in for Donald Trump. Let's listen to this. This is the start of his campaign last season, just as Donald Trump was starting to rise in real life.
Seems like everyone's afraid to speak the truth around here. Well, I'm throwing my hat in and saying, I'll figure this thing out. Now, I might not understand politics or immigration policies or the law or basic ideological concepts, but damn it, I understand there's a bunch of Canadians here, and I'm going to do something about it.
Going to do something about the Canadians. Tell us about that, about using Mr. Garrison in that way.
Well, you know, it was really brilliant in the fact that they flipped everything on its ear. Garrison was already a pretty outrageous character who always said things that, you know, would make you raise your eyebrows. So it really wasn't that big of a surprise that he necessarily became the Donald Trump character. But what was really smart and what the show does is that it sort of went at it in a different direction. And instead of having a problem with Hispanics, he had a problem with Canadians being the illegal immigrants that he wants to get rid of. And that's his driving force for, you know, how he thinks he can make the country better.
And Hillary Clinton is also featured on the show. There's not a stand-in for her like there is for Donald Trump. Ahead of the debate Clinton has with Mr. Garrison in the third episode of the season, her operatives remind her to make sure she holds the line to insist that Donald Trump, or Mr. Garrison in this case, is a liar. And then during the debate, it kind of backfires.
Okay, look, just vote for her. She knows politics. She really wants to put this country first.
My opponent is a liar.
Would you just please shut
and
up?
And he cannot be.
Get out of your own way.
Cannot be trusted.
Are they equal opportunity mockers here?
Oh, they absolutely are. This is not the first time that Hillary Clinton has been a part of the series at all. She's been featured before and is usually the butt of a joke somehow or another. So they will talk about and satirize whatever they feel like. You know, I got it straight from the guys. They're not out to, quote unquote, get anybody or change anybody's mind per se. They're equal opportunists when it comes to making fun of and joking about everything. And I think that that's really what makes the show so appealing to such a wide range of audience.
What do you think they're bringing that other comedians, other satire are not bringing in this election? We've got Saturday Night Live. We've got Samantha Bee, Stephen Colbert and others. But what's South Park bringing this different?
Well, they go at it from a different angle, which is why I think people have always loved the show. Everybody you've mentioned is doing brilliant work, but they're taking everything at face value, and they're kicking it up a notch and making it funny, which is fantastic. But with South Park, what they did in the most recent episode is a great example. They turned the Garrison Trump figure into a stand-up comedian who is a total misogynist. Now, the men in the audience love all of his horrible jokes that he's saying about women, but the women are really upset and are leaving the crowd, even though everybody was on board beforehand when he was saying his outrageous comments, which really lends itself to what's happening in the actual election.
And by the way, they have been satirizing elections for many years now. Let's listen back to season 12. This is a little bit that they did after Barack Obama won, and here's how McCain voters were reacting.
No, no, this can't happen. No!
Stephen!
It's all over, Linda. The country as we know it is about to change. We're all dead.
You don't know that, Stephen.
With an inexperienced man in president, we do know it. He's right. Game over, man. Okay? We'll
probably... You know, the funny thing is that a lot of people don't think of South Park as a political show at all.
No, they don't, and it's done on purpose. You know, Matt and Trey don't want it to be thought of as a political show. When I interviewed them most recently, they told me that, you know, they're not The Daily Show, and they don't want to be The Daily Show. But the fact that they turn episodes around so quickly every week, they're starting on their new episode Thursday, they're already working on the episode that will air next Wednesday, it allows them to be very topical, and right now, the election is what's going on. For the past few seasons, they've been working with singular storylines that have multiple offshoots, and they're allowed to do that because people consume television in a different way these days. They don't need to wrap up every episode to worry about people being lost when the episodes go into syndication. So it allows them to address much broader topics like the election.
That's Ryan Parker of The Hollywood Reporter talking with us about South Park. Ryan, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Airport expansion is always controversial. Lots of not in my backyard protests. That's playing out at a very popular airport in the UK. Today, the British government approved a third runway at Heathrow. Yes, it only had two. It's the busiest two-runway airport in the world. UK Transport Secretary Chris Grayling defended the decision in the House of Commons.
Its significance for jobs, for an economy which works for everyone, for passengers, for the global importance of our country, for the environment and for people affected by expansion. And also, Mr. Speaker, to send a very clear message today that this country is open for business.
Yeah. Well, London Mayor Sadiq Khan strongly disagrees with some of that. He called this the wrong decision for his city and the UK. The BBC's business reporter Rachel Horn is in London. In fact, we think we're hearing you at Heathrow, right, Rachel?
That's right, Robin. I've been at Heathrow since early this morning, since before it got bright, actually. I'm standing right next to the southern runway, and I can confirm that planes do take off and land every 45 seconds, actually, sorry, here at Heathrow Airport. It is a busy airport, and that is why the government started this consultation about expanding airport capacity in the South East. Now, this has been rolling on for quite some time. It was back in 2000 that the Department for Transport here in the UK said something needed to be done. Now, that followed with a series of consultations, further consultations, white papers, legal challenges, until 2012, when the Independent Airport Commission was established to look at long-term options. Now, they considered three options. One, the extra runway at Heathrow. Two, extending a current runway at Heathrow. And three, an extra second runway at Gatwick Airport.
I'm just going to jump in to say Gatwick is the other airport in the London area. It is the busiest single runway airport in the world.
Yes, we are busy here in London. There is a lot of people and a lot of freight travelling in and out of this hub. And that is why the government really thought that they needed to do something about expansion, because Heathrow is operating at full capacity and Gatwick is just years away from being at full capacity. Back in 2015, the Airport Commission decided that they wanted to go with a third runway at Heathrow. The government has had since then to make their decision. However, it doesn't end there. There's going to be a year of consultation. Then there's got to be a vote in the House of Commons. Then there will probably be more legal challenges before any ground is actually broken.
Yeah, well, look, this is astonishing to a lot of people here who just assumed Heathrow. You know, it's got to be bigger than that. I mean, Logan Airport here in Boston has six runways. Atlanta has five. Chicago has eight. Detroit has six. So the thinking was, of course, it has more than that. So people were surprised to hear that. But we understand some of the opposition is what would be opposition in any city airport, not just air pollution and the noise, which we're hearing, but homes are going to have to be destroyed to build this new third runway.
You're right, Robin. In fact, to build a new third runway at Heathrow, almost 800 homes will have to be demolished. We've also had figures showing that between 16,000 and 37,000 homes are going to be affected by noise pollution, and more than 47,000 homes are going to be affected by air pollution. Now, when the Airports Commission recommended this third runway at Heathrow, they did say that something would need to be done to mitigate those risks. Unfortunately, today, lots of residents' associations have come out protesting greatly against the third runway at Heathrow. They don't want it. However, along with announcing the third runway, Chris Grayling, the UK Transport Minister, announced a package of £2.6 billion of compensation and extra things to help local residents. That would include £700 million for noise insulation and would also include an idea of banning night flights. I mean, you can hear the sound. That's a British Airways jet just taking off right next to me. Banning night flights for 6.5 hours, which hasn't been done before, and that's something that local residents really do have an issue with. We've heard from lots today saying that they get woken up at night, their children get woken up at night, so banning those night flights may go some way to appease them.
Yeah, well, we hear that this has been a huge controversy there in London, placards all over with people saying build it at Gatwick or build it at Heathrow, you know, big public debate on this. But we heard the Transport Minister say this is a sign that Britain is open for business. Does this also have to do with Brexit, you know, the vote to leave the European Union and wanting to send a sign that Britain is not leaving, it's actually opening more with a new runway?
Absolutely. I would say that Brexit has played a factor in this. With Brexit, there's been a lot of uncertainty in the business community in the UK. What is going to happen? What is our trade position going to be? Are we going to see new tariffs, etc., as we work out our relationship with the European single market? Well, making some decisions definite that there is going to be this third runway at Heathrow has gone some way to help those business communities. We've had lots of reaction today from business communities saying it's about time, calling it a huge relief, really needing that certainty. Heathrow transports more freight by value than all of the other UK airports put together. Traditionally, it's seen more as a long-haul airport. So perhaps if the UK is going to have to start its own trade negotiations with long-haul destinations, having that hub at Heathrow could go some way to support their negotiations.
Yeah. The BBC's Rachel Horne at Heathrow Airport in London. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to join you.
Jeremy, I feel like I've gone on a little trip.
I think Flight 720 has just arrived, Robin.
That's right. In our studio. Here and Now is right. A production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at Colorado Public Radio in Denver. This is Here and Now.